This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special VJ Day edition. 75 years after the Allies finally received that commitment to surrender from Imperial Japan. What a relief it was to men, women, and children all over the globe, but especially for those who had been in captivity. One of the most well-known prisoner of war stories from the Pacific War is that of Louis Zamperini, the Olympian turned airman turned POW, who inspired the bestseller Unbroken by Laura Hillenbrand and the blockbuster film of the same name. Louis's time in captivity saw him starved and tortured, especially by a Japanese guard nicknamed the Bird. But the way he realized the war was over was something he could never forget.
It was a beautiful day. We were suspicious. You see, there's always rumors the war's over, so we didn't believe anything. But this one guard came to me and he said, a horrible thing happened in a city called Hiroshima. A cholera broke out. And nobody can communicate with Hiroshima. And I thought, cholera, my God, how horrible. I'm glad we're hundreds of miles north. But that was the first atomic bomb, and the Japanese lied to the public. Mm-hmm. But then when the second bomb was dropped, they told the truth immediately because they had no choice. So that ended the war, and then a plane flew over, and we wrote PW on the roof. They circled left. And then the Bird disappeared. He knew the war was over before we did. He skipped out and hid out in the mountains for 10 or 12 years. In the meantime, a TBF flew over from a carrier and sent us the Morse code in red light, that the war was over. And we were in the river for the first time swimming. We always wanted to go in that fresh water to clean ourselves. They wouldn't let us do it. Mm. But then the day they let us do it, I thought, well, maybe the war is over. And so anyway, we came out of there, and the TBF dropped a long red streamer, and we picked it up, and on the end was a candy bar with a bite out of it and a pack of cigarettes with one cigarette missing. We had to divide both of those up with several hundred men. We had to form circles, and one cigarette. Everybody takes one puff, and so it goes around the circle. It was really funny, but we were serious. And then the chocolate, we got a little teeny sliver just to taste it. And that was it. Now, Commander Fitzgerald of the Perch submarine, he was in command, a highest-ranking officer with us, and he made sure that everybody got one puff of cigarette and a little taste of the chocolate. And then, of course, the B-29s came over and dropped tons of food on us. And instead of hating the guards, they were complaining about their families starving at home. So we gave them a lot of food from the bombers.
Well, your stomachs probably couldn't take that much anyway.
Well, the thing is, the commander warned the guys, you know, you haven't been eating good food. You've been eating seaweed and barley for years, and so take it easy on the food. Well, some guys were so hungry, they just, pea soup was supposed to be diluted with a can of water, and they would eat it straight. So some guys got diarrhea from that, but the smart guys just ate a little bit. A little more every day until they got used to it. Yeah, I went to hell and almost got killed on the way home. You know, there was a bomber. We were supposed to fly to Manila, but socked in. I'm leaving Okinawa now. I'm gradually working my way home. And we were told to land at Loag, a small city in northern Luzon, on a fighter strip. Stayed there all night. Next day, they gave us clearance to go to Manila. And we took off with this bomber full of about 40 prisoners inside. And the runway's too short. There was a berm on the end of the runway that they put there to keep the ocean from flooding the runway. And I was up there between the pilot and co-pilot, and I knew we weren't going to make it, and they did too. We hit the berm, bounced in the air, and settled so low that the white caps came through the bomb bay doors and got all the prisoners wet. And I thought, this is it. After all I've been through, I'm dead. And then the plane gradually pulled up. We got to Manila. Now, a couple of years ago, I got a call from a fellow in the East, and he asked me how I got to Manila. When I told him about that bomber taking off, he said, well, I was the pilot, and I almost went in my pants. So, yeah, anyway, that's really funny. Yeah, so anyway, I got home, and of course, big celebrations, and and I had a ball, and then I finally got married.
You probably know the rest of that story. If you don't, pick up Unbroken and read it, or link to Louis' interview at hometownheroesradio.com. He gave you a feel of what it was like for a prisoner, but how about being one of those pilots delivering aid to men who were about to experience freedom again? One of the men who can tell that story is PBM pilot Irvin Cooper.
The war was winding down, and we heard about the atomic bomb. Strangely enough, the Japanese military would not give up. They were determined, and they had every man, woman, and child in Japan told them, when the Americans invade, whatever you do, you try to kill somebody. Little kids with sticks, stones, guns, whatever they could have. I was at a place called Ulithi, and I saw 5,000, I'm using the word 5,000 because I don't know how to describe it anymore, of ships of every kind, from battleships, cruisers, to tankers, to ships holding supplies, water, men, and all that ready to invade, a million men ready to invade Japan. And they were just standing by. And the atomic bomb went off, and the Japanese said, no, we're not going to do it again. So they did the second atomic bomb, which was at Nagasaki. And I understand the Japanese generals and all still refused. It was Hirohito himself who stepped in and said that enough is enough. But had they invaded, they would have lost, I don't know how many men they would have lost, but they would have lost millions of Japanese people too at the same time. Anyway, the bomb went off and we heard about it. And we were on a patrol, just a general patrol, whatever things were left over and stuff. And we were flying along. They gave us an assignment to go to, and I don't remember the name, prisoner of war camp, where a group of Australians were all in captive. And when I went to the plane, instead of having bombs on it, we were loaded with chocolate, with supplies for toothbrushes, teeth, oh, everything you can imagine, care packages galore, and little parachutes. And when you get over there, I want you to drop this stuff over there. So that was our mission. As we were going along, I think I was flying, and Amos was the navigator at the time. He says, hey, we're only about a half hour from Nagasaki. So we were free, and we flew over and got to Nagasaki. There was two valleys there. Japan is so green and beautiful from the sky. I remember flying along the coast and saying, I got to bring Elaine back to see this. This is unbelievable. The agriculture from the top of a little mountain down to the bottom was all just immaculately done. And we go over this beautiful valley, and the other side was completely browned out, like you could see streets in there and nothing. It was a concrete building that was sagging in the middle of it. And we flew around that thing. And sitting in the plane, I was holding, as we did, we were holding our crotch, if you'll excuse us, because we heard of this word we'd never heard of before. Radiation. What kind of word is that? Never heard of a thing like, well, it's the radiation will come. If it hits you, you won't have kids. You won't have anything. So here we are flying with our hand over our crotch, our hand on the wheel, and we're tipping around flying. We better get the hell out of here. So, and we took some pictures of it there, and we left Nagasaki. We flew over the Japanese camp. Apparently, the people that ran the camp, the Japanese soldiers or whatever, they just took off and left the prisoners there. And we dropped our supplies, and I have a picture of the prisoners coming out, taking off their shirts or whatever they had, and they wrote thanks on the ground that you can see. So that was quite an event.
PBM pilot Irvin Cooper remembering the end of the war in the Pacific 75 years ago this week. You can link to his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com, where you'll also find a two-part conversation with Bill Overmeyer. Bill had been captured on Corregidor near the start of the war in the Pacific. VJ Day meant he would be a free man again.
One day after work, the commandant, who was, we found out that he was a principal at the high school, and he spoke a little English.
Uh-huh.
And we went into the mess hall, just the officers and the non-commissioned officers. And he got up in front, he said, peace is smiling. We said, what'd you say? Peace is smiling, goo. The war is over, goo. Hallelujah. That place went up in smoke. He said, don't tell the men. Keep it quiet, please. We said, yes, we will. Until we got out the door. And we told everybody else as quick as we could.
How do you keep that news to yourself, right?
Anyway, then here came B-29s. What the heck are they doing this close? Oh, they're dropping parachutes. Oh, that's a 55-gallon drum. Oh, it dropped right in the rice field right outside our camp. A camp of 55 drums of cocoa, 55 drums of sugar, lard, anything else. And boy, we started eating like you can't believe. And I slept next to Cy Serrata. He was in the 31st Infantry at Yokohama. Right, I could touch him every night on that straw mattress. And he had gone with us, of course. He was up on a roof. One of those 55 guns hit him on the head.
Oh.
Survived 3 years. And he got, at least he didn't suffer.
They're dropping supplies to try to keep you alive, and it kills him on the roof.
The chute didn't open.
Wow.
That didn't happen very often, but it did happen.
How tragic.
But it did happen. I think I was lucky. I was fortunate in the outcome of everything that happened. Mainly, I didn't stick my neck out. We had a saying in camp, don't stick your ears out or anything out and do anything contrary to what the Japs don't like or do like. So that's what happened. And I didn't, you know, the Army term for seeking approval from a higher up. We didn't do that.
Yeah. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Anyway, we did what we had to do to survive. And you just take it day by day. I learned at Yokohama how little it takes to survive, to live, day after day. You need food. That's a question mark. You need a roof over your head. You need clothes to survive against the elements, and maybe friendship. There wasn't that much of it, but books or peace of mind that you could manufacture or whatever. That's about all you need. You don't need all this fancy living.
After all that time as a prisoner?
Yes, it was. When we were liberated from Sendai, we got on the train, and we got the same train that brought us down, and we went up to Yokohama train station. We'd passed it every day, twice. And there was American soldiers, officers, and nurses. We saw our first American nurses and workers and so forth. They sure look good, I'll tell you.
Things that could easily be taken for granted no longer were for those who had survived in captivity, not knowing if they'd ever taste freedom again. And the way the news of Japan's surrender was communicated worked out a little differently depending on where prisoners were being held. George Heimbuch had questioned whether he would make it through and whether he would ever see his brother Ray, who was also a prisoner in a different camp.
We took over our own camp when we found out that interpreters said that there was a truce. Well, we knew there was no truce. We knew it was over.
Right.
So we took over the camp, and we went out on forays, you know.
Yeah, I hear you even stole a train full of sake at one point, which is a story in itself.
Yeah, we got a truckload of sake in those in the 5-gallon jugs, you know, with those straw around it. They loaded the truck up. Two guys found it. I didn't find it. Two other guys found it. But they brought it into camp, and we had all canteens filled with it when we went on the train. They said, this train don't go to Yokohama. And Papinello said, yeah, he said, you get it ready to go to Yokohama because that's where we're going. And you know, he was on the key, you know, and they took us into Yokohama, all right.
You're liberated. And you're thinking, I'm going to get to go home, and I'll find out at some point if my brother's still alive or not, if he made it through the war as a POW. And tell me about how you bumped into him.
Well, we were in a tent. All of us were in tents, and I asked around, and nobody knew anything about my brother. Mm-hmm. And they had a staging area that where they announced guys that were going to leave that day. So every morning at 4, I'd get up and go down there, see if they'd announce his name. See? And he did the same thing. See, they announced my name. And there was a ditch there full of water, and they had a plank across it. And one morning I went down there, and it was raining. It was pretty miserable. I come back, and I stepped on that plank, and somebody was on the other end. And I said, excuse me, and I stepped up, and he said, George, this is my brother.
The guy that you asked to get off the plank was your brother.
Yeah.
I imagine that was a pretty big hug right about then.
Yeah, that was a big meeting. Yeah, we had a good time there.
A reunion made possible by the Allied victory in the Pacific secured 75 years ago this week. It's time for our final break, but when we come back, he wrote a book called The Last Fighter Pilot. On August 14th, 1945, he was in the air in his P-51, and his wingman never made it home. Remember, you can link to full-length interviews with any of the veterans you're hearing from today at hometownheroesradio.com, and our 75th anniversary VJ Day edition comes down the home stretch right after this.